This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Mayor Buddy Dyer has been re-elected to a fifth full term, extending his 16-year tenure at the helm of the City Beautiful. Orlando wasn't the only Central Florida city voting for a mayor or commissioners on Tuesday. Oviedo has a new mayor, and cities and towns from Brevard to Lake County turned out to the polls to vote for new leadership and vote on referendums on taxes and charter amendments. If your city was one of those electing new leadership or voting on a referendum, what issues got you out to the polls? You can reach out to us on Twitter with your comments and questions at WMFE Orlando, or give us a call. We're at 1-866-338-5252. We're going to start our conversation with a look at elections in Brevard County. We're joined by Dave Berman. He's the government editor for Florida Today. Thank you so much for being with us, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what was the biggest race of the night? There were a lot of kind of fairly small municipalities electing folks to city commission, et cetera. What was the standout election for you?
Well, for me, there were seven different communities with elections. One of the most interesting things in Brevard County was the Cape Canaveral elections, mm-hmm. where there were four candidates running for two seats, and an incumbent, Rocky Randles, who served for 31 years on the council, was defeated in that election. He finished third among four candidates, so that mm-hmm. was one of the more interesting surprises in the elections.
Yeah, and so, as you say, he'd been there for a number of years, and I was reading about Mike Brown. We hear a lot about what it costs to campaign, even municipal elections today, but Mike Brown, who won a seat on the council, said he spent just $400 on that race. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a lot in these local races. It's a lot to do with getting out and going door to door to the voters. And that personal contact is really what puts some candidates over the top. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a local election like this, you really can't spend too much except for maybe signs to put out on lawns. But getting that personal contact with voters is really important for a lot of people, so they connect the face with the name on the ballot and mm-hmm. maybe will put that check mark next to that candidate when they go to the polls.
And there's not a lot of money at stake in terms of the salary they draw, right? It's like a couple of $1,000s a year for the work they put in to lead the city.
Right. For example, in Cape Canaveral, it's $4,000 a year is what the city council members get. And for some of the smaller groups like in Barefoot Bay, mm-hmm. which has a board of trustees, they don't get paid at all to serve on that board.
Right. So I noted, too, in your coverage, Florida Today's coverage, Maria Callum, one of the winners on the council race in Cape Canaveral, said there'd been issues with council members being civil to each other. What did she mean by that? Has there been sort of like a history of incivility in Cape Canaveral commission meetings and the like up till now?
Well, she was one of the new candidates that just got elected, and there were some issues in Cape Canaveral where the city manager, for example, recently was fired by the city council, which has the power to fire the city manager. Mm-hmm. And they really, there was some conflict during some of the meetings where there wasn't really a full explanation of why the city manager was getting fired, and some of the councilors objected to the fact that it came up very suddenly, and they felt they should have had more time to discuss the issue. And there was some members of the public that were upset as well because of the severance benefits the outgoing city mm-hmm. manager is going to get. Mm-hmm. And now one of the issues coming up with the new council will be replacing that person with a new city manager, and they're mm-hmm. looking for one right now.
How much does that job pay, the city manager position, do you know?
I don't know the exact number, but that pays pretty well. Normally, city managers get between $60,000 to $80,000 typically mm-hmm. for a mid-sized city.
Right. So one referendum issue, too, up for a vote in Cape Canaveral. Voters voted no to allow the city to offer property tax breaks to businesses that bring full-time jobs into the city. I'm just wondering what that little vote there tells us about the economy of Cape Canaveral, and how much would city leaders have been counting on that referendum to sort of help drive that economy forward?
Well, that was an interesting vote because most votes in other communities, for example, other cities in Brevard County like Melbourne and Palm Bay do have these economic incentive programs. Mm-hmm. And Brevard County government also has such a program, and voters do have to approve these. So this was one of the first times where municipal electorate voted down this proposal, And it could mean that businesses that want to relocate into Cape Canaveral, they're looking for some incentive to do so, might look elsewhere because they don't get this incentive from the city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very close vote. It was within 2 percentage points against, I think it was 51% to 49%.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a close vote, but it was turned down. So it was a little bit of a surprise considering the history of these referendums in other communities.
Right, and there is this sort of renaissance going on the space coast with the space industry, right? You have these new companies coming in and setting up shop and sort of developing satellites, launch facilities. Is that sort of a subject of conversation that comes up around campaign season? Do candidates like to sort of tout what they would do to help attract these companies, these more of these kind of companies to Cape Canaveral?
Well, I think that's one concern is that a company that maybe would locate within the city limits might decide, well, we'll go to another community like Cocoa Beach or Titusville, where they might be able to get these type of incentives rather than or locate right on the Kennedy Space Center property.
Mm-hmm.
So Cape Canaveral, by not approving this referendum, loses a possible advantage to attract some of these companies into the within the city limits.
Right. Thinking about some of those other municipalities where they're holding elections on Tuesday night in the towns of Indian Harbour and Indian Atlantic, candidates in both those elections have talked about the health of the Indian River Lagoon. Has that been a common theme in Brevard County elections, or is it more just cities and towns that are right next to, right adjacent to the lagoon?
Well, both those communities, it's a big issue there. And countywide, the county several years ago passed a sales tax referendum where there's a 0.5% sales tax on retail purchases that go directly to projects to help the lagoon. So that's been a big issue. And that tax has raised about $40 million a year for different types of projects
mm-hmm.
that are supporting improving the condition of the lagoon, which is one of the biggest issues right now in Brevard County. It's an issue both in local governments and the municipalities as well as in the county commission. And also the Tourist Development Council also has set aside money from the hotel tax for projects to help the lagoon as well. So it's a real big issue crossing different types of local governments and crossing political party lines.
Right, so no doubt that'll be something that we'll hear more about in 2020 with elections there too. We've been speaking to Dave Berman. He's the government editor for Florida Today. Thank you for being with us, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, we'll take a closer look at some of the other races in Central Florida, including the results in Orlando elections, and we'll take your calls. What issues got you out to the polls on Tuesday night, or what made you stay home? You can reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, or give us a call 1-866-338-5252. That's when Intersection returns. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking a look at election results in municipal races across Central Florida on Tuesday. We want to hear from you too. Did you vote in that election? If so, what issues got you out to the polls? If not, why did you sit this one out? You can reach us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're also a call away at 1-866-338-5252. With me in the studio, Democratic political commentator Dick Batchel. Thanks for coming back, Dick.
Good to be back.
And we're also joined by Republican political commentator Frank Torres. Thank you as well, Frank.
Good afternoon.
So, Dick, dismal turnout once again, but Orlando Mayor Buddy Dye won handily. What does that kind of tell you about the health of the city? Is it like a temperature gauge for how he's doing there?
Well, I think so. Keep in mind that Buddy was a state senator before he became the mayor. He also ran for attorney general statewide, so he had some name recognition. And in 16 years, he's done a phenomenal job. I mean, Bill Dahl, remember that. Performing Arts Center, Orlando Magic facility, city soccer, economy's good, a lot of downtown development, a lot of high rises going up. So I think maybe the low turnout might have something to do with like the overconfidence to say he's got it,
mm-hmm.
and he did. He won by 74%, but he also raised $1 million. So, but I think there's a lot of confidence in Buddy Dyer and his leadership, and it showed up in the polls.
Just here's a tweet from one of our listeners. Paola writes, "This is definitely a small sample size, but within my friend group of college students, no one knew there was a municipal election going on Tuesday. No one had time to plan around it by the time I told them about it. could low turnout possibly be due to not knowing about that election? Thank you so much for that comment and for getting the word about the election to the extent you could, Paola. Frank, what do you think about that?
About low turnout?
Yeah.
I think, come on, guys, we need to get out there and get more involved. A lot of people are quick to complain, but when it's time for an election, they don't show up. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to love on Buddy as much as Dick did, because the region does have its challenges, and I'm a regular Buddy Dyer critic. But I will say, I mean, if we're being honest, he earned us re-election. He got us through a couple of hurricanes, and he got us through the Pulse nightclub tragedy, and those were examples of leadership. Mm-hmm. So while there are serious challenges with affordable housing and low wages, I think he was definitely the best candidate in this race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you look at his competition, Sam Ings, of course, a former police captain, retired, been on the city commission for years, to come out of the gate in a three-way race, but he just never had an opportunity. I don't think at all. It was obvious. It was 74% win. But, you know, he was outspent, but he was also outworked. But he's, and I, final note, I will say, and Frank is right, the Pulse nightclub, after that happened, the way he handled things, I think really gave him a lot of credibility.
Mm-hmm. I've got a tweet here from Kokomo Kid, who writes in actually about the Cape Canaveral referendum to give more tax exemptions for development. But development is an issue that that really sort of cuts across the board, whatever city or county you're in. Kokomo Kid writes, I voted against the Cape Canaveral referendum to give more tax exemptions for development. I don't want more traffic. Well, you know, traffic is an issue we'll talk about in the Oviedo race in a moment. But Frank Torres, you know, some of these issues are really kind of, they're close to home, right? This is what municipal elections are about. People are thinking, I'm voting for people who can take care of the issues that affect me, like how long it takes for me to get to work on my commute, you know, what schools are going up, my taxes, those kinds of things. So to your point about low turnout, what do you think the solution is, getting more people out there?
You know, the thing is that these races, they can be pretty, you know, uneventful as well. I mean, they're not partisan, so that takes away a lot of, you know, a lot of people aren't sure really what way to feel. If you look at your internet search histories or your internet research, a lot of people will try to just default by party, and in nonpartisan races, it's not always easy. And then a lot of things is that these things are happening when a lot of people aren't really in election mode. You know, mm-hmm. It's 2019. The big elections aren't until next year. So a lot of people just aren't aware that they're happening.
Mm-hmm. Sam Ings, in retrospect, just thinking about him too, Dick Batchelor, did it make sense for him to throw his hat in the ring at this point in time rather than just keep working as a city commissioner?
Not at all. I think Sam, who's been a great commissioner and representing his constituents, would have been better off had he just had a press conference say, look, I'm very humbled by you. Allow me to serve you for all these years. Here's a list of things I did for my community, and I'm going to go off and with my wife and go travel or something like that. But, you know, leaving politics by getting involved in a race against a 16-year incumbent was not an elegant way to get out of politics.
He could have had a nice farewell tour. You
Absolutely.
Know, I'm sure, and I'm sure he still will. There'll still be some celebrations.
Because he's been a very good commissioner. Mm-hmm. Very good commissioner. I want to follow up on the one thing you asked Frank about on the Space Coast, and that is, if you look at economic development, incentives for that, and you, as I understand the tweet saying it will bring more traffic, that's mm-hmm. kind of what I call the approach avoidance conflict of public policy, right? You want economic development. You want higher-paying jobs because Orange County in particular has a lot of low-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. But do you want the traffic that comes with it, the infrastructure growth that comes with it? And that's going to be debated long and hard because, as you know, Mayor Jerry Demings in Orange County is going to put on the ballot for 2020, mm-hmm. November 2020, a penny sales tax increase to raise money for infrastructure, SunRail continuation, double the fleet at Links, the bus, all those kind of things. So it's going to be interesting to see that how people say, okay, it's fine to accommodate growth, but really I don't want the growth because there's a trade-off there. So from a public policy standpoint, it's a very interesting argument.
Right. And Frank Torres, I know you have some thoughts about that sales tax. And the merits of sales taxes like that. But I wonder too, I mean, was this election a referendum in some ways on that referendum that's going to be on the ballot in 2020? Because, you know, Buddy Dyer, to Dick's point, was talking about the importance of that and saying, look, I support this. I will be putting my weight behind it in 2020. did voters kind of respond to that in some way?
I think that was the only big error Buddy Dyer made, was to put his support behind this tax to raise sales taxes when we have an affordable housing crisis and wages are low. And we're going to the citizens to ask them to accommodate growth, and we're using data from an organization that we're giving money to. So I think there's a lot of problems there.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the results of Tuesday night's election. You can give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Maybe you're one of the 12.6% of city voters who made an effort to get out there and vote in this election. Maybe you decided to stay home. Wondering what your thoughts were there, and maybe some thoughts too on increasing turnout in these municipal elections, whether they're in a off year or whether they're in a presidential or presidential election year as well. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also send us a tweet, your comments and questions at WMFE Orlando. Affordable housing then, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, this is one issue that all three of the candidates in Orlando really hit hard on. Buddy Dyer talked about some of the things that the city is doing already. Is the city doing enough though, Dick?
The city has to be. Buddy Dyer really took the lead prior to Mayor Demings being elected on the homelessness issue / affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And to the city's credit, they actually put money up for a Housing First model, which means you give wraparound services to those that you're putting there. 92% of the people have kept the housing, and these are homeless people. So it's done a lot. But the homeless issue is still a major issue. Affordable housing, if I could go to that category, is a more substantial, because if you saw the housing costs in Orange County are probably the highest on a per capita income than any place in the country. There aren't affordable houses. People who are making $50,000 a year with a family of four are paying way too much in their income and rent, can't afford houses. So affordable housing. Now, to that point, Mayor Jerry Demings has appointed an affordable housing task force. They're going to be coming up with some recommendations to try to help in affordable housing by maybe waiving impact fees, maybe some down payment assistance and things like that. But affordable housing will remain a big issue as long as we have low wages in Orange County.
Mm-hmm. One idea that I heard from one of the opponents to Buddy Dyer, Aretha Simons, was saying, look, maybe the city should, or she was saying the city should definitely look into establishing its own version of the Sadowski Trust, the sort of fund to build up resources to pay for affordable housing. Frank Torres, does that sound like a viable option? Are there some other thoughts that you've had on how to solve this conundrum?
You know, I think one thing that was brought up during the race was doing something about these application fees. We're nickel and diming these families that are already facing hardship and trying to find housing, and they're giving 50, 35, you know, they're giving this money to these property managers that have no intention on giving them the property. I mean, that's completely unfair. And you link up a couple of those payments and it starts to get expensive. As for doing enough for affordable housing, no, I don't think the city or the county is doing enough until we see results. There was a small victory with the Paramore Oaks project being completed. But no, as far as affordable housing, we are still in a crisis and we still need to see more from the city and the county.
Let's talk a little bit about the race for District 6. Now heads to a runoff between Bakari Burns and Gary Siplin. Gary Siplin, of course, a name that many political commentators and reporters will know. He has some notoriety there, been a state senator, etc. But he was leading early in the night and then was kind of pipped at the post by Bakari Burns, but neither of them got enough votes that over the 50% threshold to win outright. So this now goes to a runoff. Dick Batchelor, where do you see this race heading?
Well, a couple of things. One is, of course, you made clear that former Senator Gary Siplin is the candidate in the runoff. He's married to Orange County Commissioner Victoria Siplin, which doesn't hurt in the fundraising or exposure or name recognition. And he raised over $150,000 for a city council raise. And Bakari Burns raised about $40,000 and beat Gary in the primary. Now, what's going to happen in the general? Obviously, if you go back and look at the campaign contributions, Bakari Burns is $100 here, $25 there, $50 there. If you look at Gary Siplin's, it's $1,000 here, $1,000 there, and $5,000 there. $1,000 there.
Mm-hmm.
But so he has the ability to go raise a lot of money for the second primary and the runoff.
Doesn't have much time to do that.
But Bakari, on the other hand, doesn't have the fundraising prowess that Gary Siplin does. So, I mean, it's Siplin's to lose at this point in time, even though he came out in second place in runoff against Bukhari.
Do you see some of the elected officials already throwing their weight behind Bukhari Burns? Tipping the race, maybe?
Not in the city. I haven't seen any people endorse, and they seem to be reluctant to, for obvious reasons, because if the other candidate wins, why step into the race? And, of course, I could not imagine the mayor stepping into a city council race, particularly when one candidate's wife is a county commissioner, who's doing a great job, by the way. So she's earned her stripes. But there is some not-so-subtle politics involved in this one.
Indeed. Another tweet here. Brandon writes, and how could anyone who drives not know there was a municipal election? There were yard signs everywhere. It's not that they don't know. It's that they don't think it affects them. We need to educate people that politics on every level affect everyone. Brandon, thank you for your tweet. And Frank, I kind of hear some echoes of your sentiments at the top of the show there as well.
Yeah, and if anybody's listening, I want to know, call in and tell us, why didn't you vote? And what are you going to do next year, or what are you going to do the next time these concerns come back to you? I really want to know what the disconnect was here, if there wasn't enough GOTV. I thought the local media did all right. Pivoting back to the D6 race, Gary Siplin should have won that race. He should have won that race.
It was a low turnout election, though. It was like 1,500 votes here, 1,700 there, so not much of a margin of error.
Right, and I hope that this runoff brings more awareness to District 6 and sort of boost that income, boost that that awareness. But Bukhari Burns was endorsed by Geraldine Thompson, state representative, longtime notable lawmaker there, and she's beaten both Siplins in different contests. Ooh. So I think we're going to see a really good runoff in District 6, but I think right now Bukhari Burns is just outworking Gary Siplin.
You know, one thing I saw, Matt, not too long ago was a new study out, and it basically said in summary that you've got, you know, maybe a certain percentage on the far left, in the left, in the middle, far right, center right, but the largest portion of voters identified what they call disaffected. They've signed out. They're no longer participating in it. And as Frank says, with the upcoming 2020 election, presidential, U.S. Senate, not at U.S. Senate in this state, but congressional races down the ballot, you know, are the 30% disaffected going to stay disaffected and not participate at all? I think that's a big concern. A lot of people just sign out of politics now.
On the other hand, you do have folks who are working really, really hard to exercise their right to vote. In particular,
that's true.
One specific group who were able to vote in this election, and that's the so-called returning citizens, right? People who've gotten their right to vote back after finishing out their sentence, after being convicted of a felony. Talk to the folks on that bus tour heading off to kind of raise awareness about their efforts. So you're right. On the one hand, there are folks who, like, they have the right to vote, they just don't bother to do it. On the other hand, people really want to exercise that right and are doing everything they possibly can to do so. I want to just pivot, though, and talk about Oviedo. Frank Torres, the city has a new mayor, Megan Sladek, I'm pronouncing her name correctly. One of the issues she's been vocal about is growth, specifically just how fast that city is growing. I'm wondering if you see her putting the brakes on growth in Oviedo, because in some ways it's a bit of a dormitory community for Orlando.
Right, and I don't think she can. I don't think anybody can stop, especially with turnover this low. Listen, anybody, if you guys are interested in doing or having a voice in development in your community, and yeah, you're quick to complain when you see another project announced, you got to get to the polls. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, you're just standing there and letting it happen. Right now, the developers are just so doggone powerful in this community, and they're so well connected with their city councils and their county commissions. And I think maybe one way citizens can get more involved, or maybe one way lawmakers can help get their citizens more involved, is to move some of these city council meetings and county commission meetings to primetime hours. Have a 6 o'clock meeting, have a 7 o'clock meeting. That way we just don't have lobbyists and developers in the audience during these city commission and city council meetings.
One point I want to follow up on Frank said too, not only are the developers have incredible influence, but the legislature further empowered them under what would call a slap lawsuit. Used to be that you could go out when there was a plan unit development hearing, you could go out and oppose it because you personally don't want the encroachment of this development. Well, the legislature now has changed that and basically says if you do go oppose this project and you get sued and lose in court, you pay legal costs on both sides. There's a woman in South Florida who did this. She's facing a $4 million legal fee because she had to temerity to exercise their personal right to oppose a project. Mm-hmm. But the legislature has really fully empowered the developers now, and the local person, you're going to be reticent to say, I oppose your project on any grounds, because you could be subject to a lawsuit. And most likely, they will use it to intimidate. I think it's the worst, one of the worst pieces of legislation ever passed.
That's interesting. I'm wondering if there may be some attempts to wind that back next time around, like next
this legislature. They'll do whatever the developers want. They'll do that, too.
They might have it.
It's got a slap lawsuit. They might do it like a muzzle now. You never know.
The issue of growth, though, is interesting, though, because if you look at a city like Oviedo, you know, it's adjacent to the University of Central Florida, which is almost a city in its own right.
Right.
And East Orlando is kind of growing to meet the demands of folks who live in that area, whether they're students, whether they're people who work in that economy there. So, you know, the sort of Venn diagram of these different cities is starting to overlap. So you may be, you know, voting for the mayor of Oviedo, but what the mayor of Oviedo does has an impact on folks in unincorporated Orange County out in the east side of the city as well.
That's right. It's all connected, and all these municipal races and county commission contests and city council contests, they've all got to sign off on this development in one shape or form. And, you know, if you don't say anything, you're going to get more cars on your road. You're going to get more dense development in your communities. This a rural experience in the Orlando area. It ain't going to happen. Look at what's happening out in Horizons West out here by UCF. And people, you know, they raised their hands and they said, what happened? Well, you didn't show up to vote. Mm-hmm. So this is what you're getting.
Maybe the county should do with our local government should do like Mel Martinez did when he was the mayor and had the Martinez Doctrine, which means you couldn't just go out and build 1,000 homes unless you had a school.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you beg the question further and say, look, you can't build here until there's infrastructure in place. Now, you can accommodate the infrastructure as part of your package to build it, but maybe to guarantee that all infrastructure is in place before you can get a building permit. And that one might slow it down for review, but again,
that's a different era in politics, though, right? You're talking about the Mel Martinez era.
Yep. It was a different era and an enlightened era.
Frank, what do you think the Buddy Dyer doctrine or the Jerry Demings doctrine might look like?
I don't want to sound too brutal.
Go ahead, Frank. Be yourself.
Well, Jerry Demings has only been in office for a year. Yeah. Buddy Dyer has been in office a lot longer than that. But, you know, none of them are bad leaders. But I think they're just going to keep going back to our audience and asking them for more money to raise taxes and to fund these heavier projects that will ultimately increase traffic and make things a little bit more crowded here in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's their intention. I just think that's the only way they know how to do things these days.
Let's shift west for a moment, if we could, and talk about what happened in Lake County. So some elections there. Catherine Hoax, elected mayor of Mount Dora. She was voted out after an issue with trees being cut down, but then voted back in again. So any thoughts on what happened in Mount Dora there, Frank?
You know, politics in those Lake County areas, they are personal. I mean, you see the person, you know, in the grocery store, yeah. you stop next to them at a red light and you look at that person and they know you and you know them. And I think that's the situation we're seeing down there in Lake County. Their politics are just so personal down there.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to also go out in different directions with the span of their policies as well.
Right, and there were some interesting amendments too. I mean, thinking about Buddy Dyer and his long term and how some of his opponents brought it up, his longevity, and said that was a kind of a mark against him, whereas he sort of basically celebrated and said, look, I've spent 16 years building this city, I'm ready for another four. The city of Claremont, though, they approved an amendment to have term limits for people elected to city council. So those elected will now be limited to 8 years total with four consecutive terms. I'm kind of curious to know your thoughts, Dick and Frank, on cities of this size kind of stepping in and saying, look, we don't actually want people to be in power that long. Dick, some thoughts there? Is this going to filter up to bigger cities, do you think?
Well, keep in mind, in Orange County, the county commissioners have term limits. Of course, the city, as you pointed out, the mayor or city council members do not.
Mm-hmm.
And term limits is, I think, from a philosophical standpoint, is born out of frustration. Do I have access or influence, unfettered access to my government to influence it? And the more I think I don't, the more I want term limits, because I want you to do in term limits what I won't do at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it is. It's just people just want, they want to affect change, and they don't want to be they don't want to rely just on a vote,
mm-hmm.
you know, for a lot of the shenanigans associated with elections in politics. So,
yeah, I think a tip for all of our listeners: you want to make a politician that's around you nervous, just mention term limits. And if they're not already on it, you'll do their job. Listen, these things have been brought up in Orange County before. The county commission does have term limits, but these lawmakers aren't, for obvious reasons, aren't in a hurry to try to implement them or even work that hard to get it to the voters. They'll tell you that we already have term limits. They're called elections. And that's the philosophy that that we keep hearing out there, and I think that's the direction we're going to keep on.
Yeah, and keep in mind, too, Phil Handy years ago did an 8 is enough campaign to get a constitutional amendment to set term limits for the legislature. And, of course, there were some people who said rather than 2 terms as a state senator, 8 years, or 4 terms as a House member, 8 years. And they said, well, we want to change that now, but they'll never change it.
Mm-hmm.
And because the fact is the people are frustrated, because when you've got – when you run for the legislature in Orange County now, or South Florida, they're spending $2 to $3 million.
Insane money.
For a state Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's incredible amount of money.
Well, maybe you should move to Cape Canaveral and spend $400 to
but
win the city council.
But the point is, I think as long as money, and it, under the federal Supreme Court, Citizens United, where they basically rule that corporations are people, which is mm-hmm. the most insane Supreme Court ruling, an anti-Jeffersonian ruling I've ever heard and read. But as long as they're unfettered dollars
mm-hmm.
Coming into campaigns, people are not going to change term limits, because they think that the only way they can change leadership is in term limits, because they have lost, as an individual taxpayer, mm-hmm. small contributor, they've lost the influence they would have to throw anybody out.
I'm sure that issue is going to come up again as we look towards 2020. Well, Dick Batchelor, former state lawmaker, founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group and Democratic political analyst. Thanks again, Dick.
Thank you very much.
Frank Torres, Republican political commentator. You can find his writing about politics and culture over at theorlandoblog.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
Frank,
for having me.
I don't want somebody to know what you've said. I just won't.
Up next, have you ever wondered what it would be like to ditch the weekly supermarket shopping trip and live off the land? We'll talk to an environmental activist about his year-long experience foraging in Orlando. You may be surprised at some of the edible plants you can find in city parks. That's after the break. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to ditch the grocery store and just live off the land? One man decided to give it a go in a year-long experiment to see if he could forage or grow all of the food he would need to survive. Well, that year is almost up. I met up with Rob Greenfield recently at Dixon Azalea Park in Orlando, where he explained what he's learned about the food growing right under our noses and right overhead.
My name is Rob Greenfield, and I'm an environmental activist. My current project is to grow and forage 100% of my food for an entire year. No grocery stores, no restaurants, no food shipped long distances, anything in a package or processed. Only food that I can grow or find in nature, like this park we're standing in.
And why did you pick Orlando for this project?
Well, one of the reasons I chose Orlando is because of the year-round growing season. It's totally possible to grow a huge amount of food in most every climate. But myself, when I decided to embark on this year-long project, I had very little gardening and experience. So I wanted to choose an area where I felt like I was most likely to be successful. And the climate here is great. And then there's also a huge support network. I passed through here and I met people from Orlando Permaculture, Fleet Farming, the Florida School of Holistic Living, and I just found a huge network of permaculturists and food growers, so I knew that this was the right place to be.
And how has that experiment gone so far? You're coming to the end of it, right? You're almost up at the 12-month mark.
Yep. Today's day 355, so I have just a week and a half left, which is relieving to say, exciting to say, But I also am a little anxious for it to end because it's been a truly beautiful year. I've grown over 100 different foods. I've foraged over 200 different foods from the wild, so over 300 different species this year. And it's just been an amazing experience. This project has kept me outside every day, connecting with the earth and the resources on it. And so it's gone great. I weigh the same as when I started, so I didn't lose weight, and I feel healthy and happy. I feel like I got all the nutrients I needed.
Are you vegetarian?
No. So I fish. I mostly go over to Sebastian area and fish in the Intracoastal Waterway. And then I actually took a trip up to Wisconsin this summer, my homeland. And when I was up there, 20,000 deer are hit by cars per year and killed. So I made use of that resource. I harvested a few deer that had been hit by cars. So that was an important source of protein, the fish and then the deer up in Wisconsin.
What about here in Orlando? Have you taken advantage of some of the roadkill here?
No, I did try. But, well, first of all, in the summer, it's just too hot. So your days are kind of limited, unless you got it right away in the summer. But
so if you saw a raccoon meet its fate on a road, you could scoop that up?
I thought about raccoons plenty of times, but to be honest, it wasn't exciting. But once I found a deer, then there was no need to think about raccoons anymore. So if that had been before I ever found a deer, then a raccoon would have been an option. But I'm actually happy to say that I made it out of the year without having to eat a raccoon.
Did you have to teach yourself things or learn about things like how to dress the animal and preparation and that kind of thing as well?
Yeah, this whole thing was just a one long learning experience, whether it was foods or whether it was plants or animals. And I used a lot of online resources. There's a lot of foragers out there that I was able to learn from. Here in Orlando, there's someone named Green Dean who does edible weed walks. And I went out with him and learned dozens of edible plants by going out with him and other foragers. So, I wouldn't be able to be standing here today if it wasn't for all the knowledge from the people that have been doing this for a long time before me.
So we are in Dixon Azalea Park, and it's kind of this little oasis in the middle of Orlando, right? You feel like you're not really in Orlando here. You can hear the sounds of the city, the planes whizzing overhead, the cars going by, but it's a bit of an oasis. So what's special about this park?
Well, this park is that, just a quiet place. It's 3 miles bike ride from where I live in Audubon Park, and I can come here and I can really unwind and, hear the trickling of the water. And Orlando is a difficult place for me to live because of the noise and the busyness. So this is a little oasis, but it's also an edible oasis. There's about a dozen different species of foods that I've harvested here that are, delicious and nutritious and have helped me to survive over the last year.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to just take a little walk and see what we've got?
Sure. An interesting thing that I've learned is if you're looking for fruit in trees, often the best place to look is at the ground, because when fruit is ripe, it's falling. So as far as I know, all date or all palm fruits or almost all palm fruits are edible. However, I don't know this palm fruit. And the number one rule of foraging is you only eat something you're 100% certain of, and you're supposed to triple confirm it. So checking with three sources. So as much as I'd like to taste this, I'm going to follow the basic rule, and that is only eat things that you can for sure identify.
So how do you go about that triple confirmation of something? You whip out your phone and check a picture, or do you call a friend? What do you do? What's your process?
Well, I have a couple of guidebooks that I'll look through, and they kind of cover the most common foods, a lot of them, or the most easily forageable foods. So there's a good chance I'll find things in there. And then there's Facebook groups. And then there's Green Dean's website where, pretty much if it's a forageable item in Florida, there's a good chance it's on his website or his forum. So that's one of my big resources. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the main thing I do is I stick to kind of what's easy. I have foraged over 200 species in the last year, but I'm still very much a novice. And so I walk past things still every day that would be a great snack or a great addition to my meals, but I walk by them clueless as to their edibility.
So we're looking at the palm fruits here, and further up the path, you pointed out some nuts that have fallen on the ground. You got one in your hand now. What is that?
Yeah, so this is a hickory nut, and this is a delicious nut related to walnut, very similar flavor. Smaller, though, and what I do with these is I crush the shell and the nut meat inside together, put it into a pot and boil it, and that makes nut milk because it's too hard to extract all the pieces. So I would break this open right now and eat it, but one of the problems of Florida is there's not that many rocks. So if you don't have a tool with you, it's hard to break things in the wild in the state of Florida. Here's a rock. All right, so this is a hickory nut. Whoops, I smashed it way too hard. And this turned out to be a rotten one anyway, which is maybe why the squirrels hadn't eaten this one yet. This is definitely one of the foods of the squirrels of the park. Here's a... Okay, I found another one. The shell I'm peeling off. This one should still be good. Hit it lighter. Dang, rotten as well. Good thing I have sweet potato lunch waiting for me at home.
And is that sweet potato you just found growing somewhere?
No. So one of my main staples has been my garden, for sure. Probably half of the food that I eat I grow and half is foraged, maybe. And I've grown probably 500 to 600 pounds of sweet potato. That's been one of my absolute main staples. It's one of the easiest foods to grow in Central Florida. You can eat the leaves, which are highly nutritious, and the tubers. And supposedly, it's one of the best plants on earth to grow commercially as far as the most nutrients and calories per square acre.
What about flavoring? Do you find yourself craving some spices or something, or is that something that you've been able to forage or grow yourself too?
Yeah, I've probably foraged a few dozen different herbs and spices, and then I grow a lot of them as well. I have your standards like rosemary, thyme, oregano, dill, coriander, basil. So I grow a lot of those, and then there's just so many things that herbs that grow in the wild as well. A lot of them are leaves on trees. I harvest bay leaves from the wild, for example. And then I also harvest my own sea salt from the ocean, which is just as simple as taking a trip to the ocean, filling up a jug, putting that in a pot, boiling it down, the water evaporates, and then I'm left with pure sea salt.
It'd be a tough life without a little bit of salt in your food, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I've thought about doing this project in a northern climate, such as Wisconsin, where I'm from, and I don't know what I'd do about salt up there. That would be difficult. Well, here's a plant right here. This is wood sorrel, and this is a favorite of children. It's actually got a sort of lemony, tangy flavor. So a lot of kids, this is one of their first experiences. It looks like clover. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would think it's clover, but it's actually sorrel.
So do you use it as a herb, or do you kind of just eat it en masse?
Salad greens. You can also blend it to make a nice salad dressing as well, because it's kind of a natural lemon replacement.
Further along the path, Greenfield points out a grapefruit tree.
There is one right there, which I could... Oh, there's actually a lot of them up there. Actually, you know, one way to get fruits from trees is climb them and then shake them. And the good thing about... Oh, there goes one. The good thing about this method is the ripest ones will come down. So it gives you the best ones.
So you get a workout in your day.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things about this lifestyle is your food is also your exercise, you know? I believe in basic movement as a form of exercise. That was a little more than basic. But for me, it's about a more natural way of life where we're just getting our exercise through gardening, through biking to work, to school, and such. We don't need to spend $100 a month on a membership to a weight room if we garden, if we grow some of our food, and we just bike or walk. And so the nice thing about this project for me is this forces me outside to collect my grapefruits rather than going to the store. One of my, you know, initiatives while I'm here, planting community fruit trees, and I've planted about 200 fruit trees around Orlando that are publicly available for anyone to pick from. And the idea is to help people, you know, eat more healthy food right from the streets. Right here we're walking across a mulberry. This is the one that's just raining to the ground usually. And this right here kind of is the epitome of my dream. Just being able to walk down sidewalks and just have delicious and nutritious fruit growing for free everywhere for everyone to enjoy. And yeah, this right here is kind of one of my favorite spots in Orlando. We're actually at another spot that holds a memory, and that is there was a rooster here about 6 months ago, and I came with a net to try to catch it and eat it when I was very much in need of some protein, long before I found the deer. But that rooster was fast. I talked to the people in this neighborhood, and they said it had been in this park for over a year. So at that point, I considered that thing basically rewilded and considered that foraging, but it got the best of me. And I don't know where it is now, because the last few times I've been back, it's not around anymore.
What do you want people to take away from learning about your year spent foraging in Orlando?
Well, a lot of people look at the state of the world and they just think, they're 1 in 7 billion people, so what's the point in even trying? Is it possible to make a difference? And basically, the answer for me is yes. And not because I think we can solve the global crises that we face today, but simply because I believe that life matters and that we can use our lives to improve the quality of other people's lives around us, humans, other species, and just the environment that we live in as a whole. So my hopes is that by me doing this sort of extreme thing that brings people into this journey, that they walk away with some inspiration and some empowerment to be a part of the basic solutions, which could be, you know, going to the local farmers market and supporting local businesses. It could be, you know, buying less packaged processed foods that leave behind, you know, millions of pounds of trash for future generations. It could be trying to source, you know, organic foods that don't pollute our waterways that, you know, we're so dependent upon here in Florida. So that's the hopes, is really that people adapt small changes that add up over time to, you know, to make a meaningful difference.
What do you think you're going to miss about not being a forager once you return to civilization?
So my goal is to always be doing some foraging still wherever I go and connecting with local foragers and, you know, buying as much local food as I can. But entering civilization, as you said, I'm going to enter back into the convenience and the ease of the system, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of time that goes by where I don't go out foraging, and I'm spending more time inside and more time on the computer and less time outside. So I'm definitely going to miss the basic connection to nature that this sort of forces me to do.
And what are you most looking forward to about not living like you have for the last 12 months?
So I'm not actually missing any particular food. It's actually what I'm really excited about is the community of food, rejoining the community food in a different way, making healthy meals with friends, going and getting ingredients from the farmers market. And, you know, food is the center of so much of our social lives. So just being able to be more social with food again, because there's been times when this has been a bit of an isolating project.
Are you a coffee drinker?
Not a coffee drinker. That's made this a lot easier than it would be for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm going to say it'd be hard to go cold turkey on that.
Yeah, but luckily there's a plant that's native to Florida called yaupon holly, or yaupon holly, and that's North America's only native caffeinated plant. It's a cousin to yerba mate, and so I have gotten my caffeine in this year.
You've gotten a fairly unique look at Orlando from living here for a year. I'm sure not many people get to see the city the way you have. Are you going to be back, do you think, in the future?
I will be back in Orlando during my book tour for this project, and that will be in the winter of 2020, spring of 2021. So Orlando will definitely remain in my heart, and I'll definitely be back here, you know, every so often.
You think you'll come back with your net for that rooster?
I think the rooster's gone, and at that point, I shouldn't need to chase the rooster.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And Rob Greenfield's writing a book about his experiences growing and foraging his own food. There'll be a link with more details on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. We're in our full silent drive. If you're not a member yet, consider making a donation. Just $5 or $10 a month helps keep local programs like Intersection on the air. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.